Great to be here. Let's see, John, I had a papers there. You might have taken them with you. There we go. Thank you very much. Well, I've never had any stand, but when I came in, that's a beautiful moment of reverence. Thank you very much. I remember years ago, UCSB, 43 years ago, being in Campbell Hall and listening to the opening lecture of cultural anthropology. And there was a great professor, Dr. Madsen, and he was a soulful scholar, which is the best kind. And I remember him saying as part of his lecture, why would you study anthropology? And he said, well, you study psychology to find out what's wrong with you, sociology to find out who to blame, and anthropology where you can move to go fit in somewhere. And feels to me like this group is kind of my people. Don George was telling me that Father Virgil helped begin this group years ago, and like thousands of people, I considered Virgil an inspiration and a friend. And the whole journey of using our minds in the service of something mysterious and profound, that's what makes life luscious and good and hopefully productive in the things we do in society. So I'm honored today to come and speak about compassion in hospice care. I was on the board of Hospice of Santa Barbara, I think about 2005 or 6, and I've been the director since 2008. But I'm aware in this room there are people who were part of hospice in the 70s. I know Ann Jacqua was, I believe, and Don George, and I think Jude. Are there other people that were involved in hospice in the 70s or the 80s, early days? Because I know this is... So in a sense, I'm kind of way down the line there, but coming back to, if some of you aren't aware of what we've been doing, most of my talk will not be about specifically our programs or anything, more about hospice and compassion care in general. But I'm very cognizant of the fact that there are folks here who have been pioneers in this for 4 decades. So I'm going to have you do just a quick exercise in a second, but then I'm going to kind of talk a little bit about hospice movement, how it's gotten to this point. Then I'm going to look at a section called Contemporary Conceptual Foundations, just some key people in the 50s, 60s, and up to the present, who have framed these issues in ways that I find very meaningful and useful. And then I can't help but we're going to take a little moment and we're going to look at what this conceptual framework, how that relates to Buddhism, Jesus, Dante, and Beethoven, just for a few minutes. And then we'll come back and the last part will be talking pragmatically about how do we make these things happen in people's lives, in our lives, and people in our community. Some of that will be about things that we're doing in town, but also very much about your own life and your own relationships, of how to take some of these things that in the world of hospice we find to be very valuable and make them real. Because in the end, it comes down to pretty nitty-gritty stuff. It comes down to the most basic aspects of human connection and caring. But on the sheet, if everybody hopefully has one of these base sheets, I'm going to ask you just to take a minute, and if you have something to write with, on the back, it has good and bad. So, I know Karen Armstrong is certainly reluctant to divide the world into good and bad too quickly, but... okay, I guess we're out, but it'll be okay. It's a simple thing. Share a hymnal if you need to. But basically, I just put good and bad on the back because I want you to think for just a minute about what's a good death and what's a bad death from your experience. So if I think about a good death, I think last September my father died at Val Verde, and I was there when he died. My sisters had been there, and they were back soon thereafter. And we'd had plenty of time to celebrate my dad at his 90th birthday when he could appreciate everything. And I think he would have liked to not live that long. I think his quality of life had been declining. But in terms of a death, to be able to be with, you know, in that situation with us, be there for his last breath and no pain, that was a good death. Contrast that with the death of my nephew, who in a moment of despair committed suicide alone in a hotel room. So there's a good death. And there's a bad death, and I'm guessing most of us have seen both in our life. We're going to come back to this, I think, for the discussion time, but just think for a minute, and if you have something to write, just put a few notes. What's a good death? You think about a person that you've seen die. What made it good? And if you've seen some that you think are tragic, or you say, I wish that could have been different, just put a few qualities about what makes a bad death. I'm going to take a couple minutes, and then we'll put that aside and We'll start with just a very simple story. There was, some years ago, a woman I know who was a nursing student, and she was training in Nova Scotia, and part of her training was to be at a veterans hospital in Nova Scotia. And the dorms for the nurses were on one floor, and above the floor above them was one of the wards where some of the men were dying. And she tells the story about... In those days, it was considered the best treatment you could give somebody who was dying was to be very specific with medication on a very specific schedule. So they should get pain meds every 4 hours. But she would try to sleep at night, and above her, as those pain meds wore off, she would hear these guys crying out and screaming and moaning. But her supervisor told her, wait until it's time to go for the next medication. Don't go up there. That's not the way we do it. And she tells the story that at that time, she thought, this isn't right. There's something wrong here. So I'm going to come back to that story a little bit later. But let me go into where that feeling of it's not right led. I'll start with the word hospice. The word hospice is interesting because it's the same root as hospitality. Often we think of it maybe in a medical terms, like here in town, Serenity House, or we may, if we in our mind's eye, we might see IVs and a nurse and a bed. But the root of it is hospitality. And as you may know, in the Middle Ages, when somebody was on a journey, a pilgrimage, a place that they would stay in an unfamiliar land was called a hospice. There may or may not be anybody dying there, but it was a place as a stranger I could go and I could trust that they recognized I was a stranger. They would protect me and they would care for me and they would give me whatever directions I needed to continue on my journey. And when I was ready to set out, I could do that. Now, in 1999, I was going to be going to Jerusalem for the first time, to Israel, on my own pilgrimage. And Richard Hecht, professor of Jewish studies at UCSB, I saw that he was teaching a class on the history and politics of Jerusalem. So I signed up to audit his class, and it was great. It was fascinating to learn about Jerusalem. But I had lunch with Dr. Hecht, and I said, look, I'll be there in the summer. Where should I stay? And he said, oh, there's only one place I stay, and that's the Scottish Hospice. And I thought, you know, a medical ward with kilts? I mean, I couldn't quite figure out what a Scottish hospice was. But I said, is this a place where people are dying? And he says, no. It's the old meaning of hospice. It's a place for people on pilgrimage. And the Church of Scotland in the 20s created this. It's like a bed and breakfast. But the difference is that the purpose of this bed and breakfast isn't necessarily to have a beautiful croissant. And it's not like a five-star hotel where it's to feel important. But it's for people on a journey, and everybody has breakfast together. But the staff there knows Jerusalem, Israel, is connected with the Palestinians and the Israelis. And anything you need to know, they can tell you, but they're only going to communicate with you if you ask them, because you can just be on your own. So when I went to Jerusalem, I stayed at the Scottish Hospice, both in Jerusalem and then up in Tiberias, up in the Galilee, and it's exactly what it was. So that route, back in the Middle Ages, of hospice being a place, you're in a strange land, you need a place of refuge, that's what hospice meant. Now, in the Middle Ages, there were also true, what we think of full hospices in terms of people that were dying. And, of course, ancient cultures had many, many rituals around dying. Richard Groves, who's taught an Anamkara project all over the country, and he was at La Casa for a couple of years, he has a beautiful illustration of one particular hospice in France where the nuns would bring the dying in, many of them, the dying, very poor, and this beautiful building. But right through the center of it was a glass, glass ran down the center floor, and underneath it was a river that was flowing. So to think back in the Middle Ages, if you're dying and you're there, you're cared for, you're prayed for, a lot of the music was really tuned to where you were in your dying process, and at night you would hear river flowing. Once the Inquisition came, a lot of those hospices got shut down. And coming up into the present time, getting back to my nurse's story, death became very medicalized, as a lot of you know. And I often think of it analogous to the birthing, the process of giving birth. When my mother gave birth to me and my siblings, there was a man in a white coat that was completely in control, gave her no choices, decided when the family could come, which was minimal amount of time, and would kind of keep her in the dark because that was the authority of the medical system. And my daughter, when she gave birth to our grandson, she chose to have it in home with a midwife and a doula, my son-in-law videotaping the whole thing. So very different generationally, birthing in the 50s from in the recent decade. And dying was in that similar kind of thing, a very medicalized process. So a lot of you know Cicely Saunders. She was kind of the legend pioneer in the hospice movement in England. She started out a nurse, and then she realized there was more to caring for the dying. There was about social relationships, so she became a social worker. And then she really began to figure out what was important to how to serve the dying better. And so but realized nobody's going to listen to her as just a social worker or a nurse, so she became a physician. So she was a nurse, social worker, and physician, and finally she got some traction. And it actually, if you know her life story, it's interesting. It's very much out of a spiritual calling, out of a spiritual, some scripture that really spoke to her. Profoundly spiritual person. But she founded St. Christopher's Hospice in London, which is still operating to this day. And part of her just very basic belief is that when we talk about pain, there's more than one kind of pain. She had the term of total pain, which is there could be physical pain, mental pain, emotional pain, and spiritual pain. And when anyone is dying, anybody who really wants to care for them needs to think about what kind of physical pain can we address. Is there mental pain? Is there psychological issues or conflicts that are really coming to the fore? Emotionally, are there feelings towards others or towards family or towards their life that need to be resolved? And depending on the person, what's the spiritual dimension of pain? Are they getting to a point where they're feeling like, what did my life really mean anything at all? Or asking the question, is God punishing me? Is that why this is happening to me? So Cicely Saunders, really, her framework was, look at the total person. And as some of you, I'm sure, know, St. Christopher's Hospice, it was a very different kind of a medical facility. There were physicians there looking at pain. But if Dad was dying and he liked to have scotch and he liked to have the dog visit, they would arrange to make sure he could have scotch when he wanted in the dog visit. And I think one of the most memorable stories is supposedly, according to one of our former directors who was with us a long time, there was a special happy hour cart that went around at St. Christopher's Hospice that if you wanted a drink, and the drink was cocaine, morphine, gin, and cherry juice. So if you've got a few days left, in contrast to that Nova Scotia hospital, that cart would come down and, you know, it even beats Harry's bucket martinis. But it was the sense of, come on, let's be real. You know, I wouldn't give this to my kids. But if somebody's dying and they've got a lot of pain, and at 5 o'clock, if they want something to relieve their pain, why not give it to them? You know, Why not to let them feel the feel of the dog's fur of their dog that they loved all the time? Why not let them see the family? And why not let the family see them and interact? In Hospice Santa Barbara, we talk about death and dying represents an opportunity. We usually don't think of it that way. It's not something, an opportunity we seek. But it is in human life and in the human psyche, the human spirit, it's going to be happening. And the question is it something that we push far away, or does it become through, not in an easy way, but does it become an opportunity for us to go deeper into what life's all about? Another great figure in the modern movement is a physician, Eric Cassell. He's a wonderful medical expert in this field. And he wrote a book, The Meaning of Suffering. And when I started Hospice Santa Barbara, some of you may know Dr. Mike Bordofsky, who's a wonderful physician in town and has really been a great leader in establishing palliative care at Cottage Hospital and things. And when I first met Mike, I said, what book should I read to understand this field? He goes, read The Meaning of Suffering by Eric Cassell. And so Eric Cassell distinguishes pain from suffering, kind of like Cicely Saunders, that I can have pain, but what's the meaning of it? That's the suffering. So suffering occurs when the impending destruction of the person is perceived. So two people may have a similar pain, but one may mean something very different than it does to the other person. I remember I heard Cassell speak at a conference in Austin a few years ago, and he talked about what's suffering. He said, suffering is one of my patients who is very well-to-do person, very always well-dressed, but at this stage in her life, standing there with no clothes on in the exam room and unable to control her excretions. That's suffering. He also said, when I heard him speak, I gave the keynote at a big conference, he said, healthy people bore me because they waste so damn much time. But my patients get right to the point, and that's why I love them. He also said whenever he goes to visit a hospital, usually the hospital staff wants to show him the newest technology, the newest fancy machine. But he says, I know probably right next to that is a room where somebody is alone and suffering. But all they want to show me is the new machine. So he's somebody who really, for physicians, and his book is read in all kinds of medical schools, really speaks strongly to this idea that the pain is one part of it, like Cicely Saunders. But what does it mean to the person? I heard Betty Farrell, who from the City of Hope, speak on this once. She talked about being in a circle of women with breast cancer, and as they go around to check in and talk about different things, one particular woman who was new just didn't really say much, and where other women were talking, weeping and all this kind of stuff, and how hard it was. This other woman was just kind of like, meh. So Betty thought, well, she must be blocking something. So afterwards, she had a chance to talk to her and kind of gently open this idea of why wasn't she really engaging, in terms of the breast cancer that she had. She said, we lost our home in Katrina. Then a year or two later, my husband died. A year or two later, we lost my son. This is just breast cancer. So that whole thing of perspective and the dimensions of it, and for each one of us, that's unique. So in the hospice world, Hospice Santa Barbara, every person who we encounter, patient or in grief work, our biggest task is to get to know who they are as a human being and to know what's important to them. What's the meaning of what's happening to them? And insofar as we can be involved in helping open up meaning, new growth for them, new opportunities for different things, which we'll look at, that's what it's really all about. Another special person in this movement is a physician named Balfour Mount from Canada, and he wrote a very important article in the Journal of Pain and Symptom Management called Healing Connections on Moving from Suffering to a Sense of Well-Being. And like I asked you at the beginning to think about what's a good death, what's not a good death, they looked at patients that they were dealing with and they tried to categorize them with this death. Did it become meaningful or was there a lot of suffering? And if so, what are the similarities? So when there is suffering and anguish, here are the common themes. A sense of disconnection from self, others, phenomenal world, ultimate meaning. A crisis of meaning. An existential vacuum. Inability to find solace or peace. A preoccupation with the future or the past. Going back, going forward, but never being in the middle. A sense of victimization. That this something is doing this to me. And a need to be in control when one is not going to be in control. I remember doing a presentation at La Casa on technology and how it's affecting our life. And an ICU nurse said that it's been her experience often in the ICU that when somebody's finally getting down to their last days and their doctor said there's nothing more we can do, sometimes the patient will say, well, now I know he said that, but could you get whatever it is that you do at this point that you must have in the back room or something to really get me through this? And she has to say that there is nothing else. But we are in a culture that believes there should always be one more thing that we can control. There should be a technology, a pharmaceutical, some magic potion that we can be back in control. But death has a way of instructing us that there is something bigger. So in contrast to where the suffering is in Balfour at Mount Study, is where is their integrity and wholeness that their team observed in this process? And it's pretty much the reverse of those other qualities. A sense of connection to self, others, phenomenal world, ultimate meaning. A sense of meaning in the context of suffering. Capacity to find peace in the present moment. Experience of a sympathetic, non-adversarial connection to the disease process. And the ability to choose attitude to adversity, open to potential in the moment greater than the need for control. Now, you look at that. That's about dying, folks. But in all of us in our spiritual journeys, that's a pretty good description of what we'd want to try to achieve in a daily way. So I think for all of us in the work, there's a real profound connection between what can be hopefully dying well, but living well. And I think most of these things on that are here, these are things that, you know, are worthy of seeking every day. So somebody else who's in town, Dr. Michael Carney, who's an amazing physician, and he'd be a great speaker here sometime. Michael was a physician, he's in medical school. He'd been a film and literature major undergrad. He was getting discouraged with the medical profession. He told his supervisor, I'm going to quit medicine, go back and study literature and film. And he said, go to St. Christopher's Hospice in London for a week because that's where healing happens. So Michael went to St. Christopher's Hospital. That Cicely Saunders was still there, and he spent a week there, and it completely changed his medical practice. So he's become an internationally known palliative care physician dealing with death and dying. And Michael's a wonderful person, and he lives here in Santa Barbara. He's at Cottage Hospital right now as we speak, making rounds for people who need his help. But he's also got a degree at Pacifica, and his real interest is in death psychology and Greek mythology and how it impacts the work that he does. And Michael, one of the simplest, he did a presentation for us at La Casa, and he had a great image, which he said that when mortality comes close, the ego tries to retract as much as it can, tries to fight it. And he said he had a friend who had a cat that every time there was a thunderstorm, the cat would disappear. And they couldn't figure out where this cat went. And after a number of times of just totally not figuring it out, they thought, we're going to really search the house. Next thunderstorm, we're going to search the house. So they finally, upstairs, looked under a bed, and the cat was holding onto the box springs with all four paws, just totally dug in. And Michael said, that's what the ego feels like when mortality approaches. And how do you get a cat out of a box spring? You probably will rip your box spring if you try to use force. But he said you have to be patient for that. The cat has to feel safe enough eventually, probably when the thunder stops, to kind of slowly let go. And maybe if you're there, that might help a little. And he said in the hospice world, it's all about order and care. If I'm in that crisis, to start giving some order to my daily life that I can depend on, because I'm experiencing chaos, but some sense of order But all of that delivered with a sense of compassion and care. This was one of, in Michael's book, he talks very simply about what are the patient experience. There's some things are responsive to medical model of caring. Some things aren't. Some people can have pain. All kinds of pain medication isn't going to stop the pain because it's emotional, spiritual, or social. And then I want to go on. There's a significant movement going on in medical education and in hospitals across the country of integrating spirituality more into end-of-life care. But spirituality is a very elusive word. And so several years ago, a group was convened. City of Hope was one of the main conveners. They got 60 people in a room for a few days and said, you got to come up with a definition of spirituality. And there were religious people, secular, atheists, psychiatrists, chaplains, all kinds of folks. They hammered it out. Something that Congress wasn't able to do recently. But this is the definition they came up with, and it's a little heavy. It's kind of hard to throw this off casually, but it's interesting. Spirituality is the aspect of humanity that refers to the way individuals seek and express meaning and purpose, and the way they experience their connectedness to the moment, to self, to others, to nature, and to the significant or sacred. So the key word in this to me is connectedness. When I looked at this, everything this implies, the fulcrum is connectedness. And like that other study, when I'm feeling disconnected from people, the moment, nature, whatever is ultimately meaningful for me, that's not as desirable as feeling connected. And when we feel connected, it's a powerful, powerful thing. Here's something that we experience in. We right now at Hospice Santa Barbara, we're serving about 170 children and teenagers who've lost somebody, a mom or a dad or a brother or sister. And kids are incredible. Kids are more direct, of course, than adults. And there was a Wall Street Journal article published a few years ago, a study of kids who had been affected by 9/11 and checking in with them several years later. And this is from the Wall Street Journal article. Once thought possible only in adults, this post-traumatic growth is marked by increases in self-esteem and compassion, a greater appreciation for relationships, and a deeper sense of meaning or spirituality. This is the Wall Street Journal. I like it. It's the Wall Street Journal. Meaning or spirituality. Children may say, for example, that they learned as a result of a disaster, quote, how nice and helpful people can be, unquote, may feel better able to handle big problems, or they may appreciate each day more, feel closer to other people, or believe they understand better how God works. I mean, that's kids who've experienced trauma. Now, as we know, not all kids who experience trauma have this outcome, just like adults after trauma. And a lot of the work we do is to try to make it possible to find that growth rather than the depression, anger, and everything else that can be the alternative. But it's embedded in the human spirit, in kids and adults. And a lot of what compassion and hospice care is all about is tapping into that and helping people find not what is something ready-made formula that we have on the shelf to give to somebody, but what is it for them? What is personally meaningful for them? Now, in that, this series that Karen's book is about compassion and hospice care. And I'm going to pull in a little namaste here. Because a couple years, I was at a week-long retreat sponsored by the Mehta Institute, which is an outgrowth of the Zen Hospice in San Francisco. And Frank Ostateski, who's spoken here at the Libero as part of Mind Supermind before, is a wonderful guy, and he trains end-of-life practitioners in mindfulness, cultivating presence, those kinds of things. And one thing he said at one of the conferences, I don't know if we have any Buddhist scholars that can read the original Pali or whatever, that where the word namaste came from, but he said the meaning of namaste isn't just this. It's actually got two parts. One part's compassion, and the other part is wisdom. compassion and wisdom. And the reason why I think that, and why Frank felt it was important, and the way we think it's important, because sometimes compassion can lead us to do things that aren't smart. I think of kids who want to bring home 9 kittens or something because they see the kitten, and as a parent you have to say, you know, I also feel empathy for the 9 kittens, but we can't take care of the kittens. We have a mentor program where we match mentors, adults who lost a parent or sibling when they were young, and were able to eventually grow and incorporate that into their life, with children, kids who had just experienced such a loss. So a 8-year-old who lost his mom will be linked with a mom who lost her mom at age 8 or something like that. And one time we had a mentor who was serving a low-income family, and when he dropped the young boy off, he realized that the family had hardly any food. So he had compassion for them. So he and a friend said, let's really do something. So they went out to Costco, and they bought $1,000 worth of food, and they brought it back to give to the family. The trick was the family didn't have a refrigerator. And the mentor had no idea really what the family ate, you know? So the compassion, which was, I want to really make an impact on this person's life, was certainly there, but it needed the wisdom of what's culturally appropriate. What's appropriate for this family in this moment, you know? So ever since Frank mentioned this with Namaste, I think about compassion plus wisdom. And I know Kimberly Snow, some of you know, who's a local Buddhist writer, talks about stupid compassion that, you know, that can get us into trouble. I know another thing recently, with people that are dying, often there's a desire to give them water in the last day or two, but for many people, to stop drinking water is actually part of the body's process of shutting down. And it actually, in that dehydration, it releases some natural painkillers that are in the body. So I may say, oh, the person, I have compassion for this person who's dying. It looks like they're dry, they need something, so I'll almost force water because I have compassion. But the wisdom's missing. You know, the medical wisdom is saying, actually, at this point, maybe last week that was the right thing. At this point, no, we're letting the body run its own course. So compassion is fabulous. But when we train volunteers and we all do our work and mentors and everything else, we really try to make a point of, we feel the compassion, let's remember, look for the wisdom. And we find it in each other and in people that have gone before us. So we like to see Namaste nice together. Okay, this is kind of where the practice is these days, compassion, hospice, care. I'm going to take a real quick step back. In light of some of these concepts, one little point from Buddhism, as a lot of you know, and Karen mentions in her book, the 4 passing sights, where Buddha, the different versions of whether it was inside a palace or whether he jumped the wall and went out to look for the world. But he sees, a older person, a sick person, and a corpse. And it totally shakes him up. And it's only when he sees the monk that he thinks these first 3 visions, aging, illness, death, these shake me to the core. I have not been exposed to these. I don't understand these. How do you deal with these? And then, of course, he sees the monk, which leads him on eventually to his enlightenment. I think about the 4 passing sights almost every time I go into a nursing home. And to think about how hard it is sometimes to walk into nursing homes. Because what do we see? We see aging, and we see illness, and we see people close to death. So that very theme of connection that in the Balfour Mount study, in that definition of spirituality, all of these scenes are scenes of people getting disconnected from society. These people are on the side of the road in this rendition in Indian culture back at the time. And certainly a big part, to me, if I link the modern concepts around hospice care with the 4 passing sights, it's that our call is to make connections with the sick and the aging and the dead of the dying and the families after the dying. That's part of being the monk. Now, similarly, in Jesus' own life and ministry, apart from any particular teaching, this is the 100 Guilder print by Rembrandt. And one reason why it made me think about this is that for today, is that this is a little piece of that. And you look here, and some of the people gathered around Jesus while he's talking are those same people that are in Buddha's, in the passing sites. And we know that when Jesus was out doing his ministry, all kinds of people were drawn to him. And they found a connection in him. They found no judgment. They found no separation, which ritual purity cult practice of the time was very strong on. They found that he touched them, and he honored them, and he gave them dignity. That's that connection piece that in the modern hospice world talk about all the time. And to me, in Buddha's life and in Jesus' life, it's right there. I love Dante. Fell in love with Dante a few years ago. So anytime I'm giving a presentation, I try to find some way to include something about Dante just to kind of release it. But just real quickly, you know, in Dante's story of the Divine Comedy, he starts by, in the middle of his years, he finds himself in a dark wood and he's lost, which is kind of that aloneness, that disconnectedness. And then Virgil, Father Virgil, being the patriarch of this group, well, the poet Virgil takes Dante down through Inferno, through hell. And what's interesting for today about that is that one of the aspects of every character that he meets in Inferno is that they blame everybody else for what's happened to them. And they take no responsibility. And they're totally cut off from light, the sun, and they're totally, really cut off from each other in any meaningful way. When you go to purgatory, when you get to go to purgatory, you've still got issues to work with, but you realize it, and you're humble, and you journey with other people, and you sing. So you're climbing, but you're no longer alone. You haven't figured everything out. You're not in samadhi, nirvana, or paradise. But you realize that part of what I need is other people, and there's a constant singing of hymns as you go up this journey. And as you may know, if you know purgatory, you don't travel at night because you can't see. The sun only, you have to travel when the sun's out, and the sun represents God's guiding light. So you only travel when you got guiding light. Otherwise, you just stay put. When you get to paradise, then things change in another way. You no longer have any concern about yourself. You're totally enchanted by God and other people. And in one of the circles, some of you may know which circle it is, the Franciscans and the Dominicans back in Dante's time were often in battles, like lots of religious groups within a denomination are. But in paradise, he runs into Franciscans and Dominicans that almost just want to take turns talking about how wonderful the other one is. You know, oh, no, the Franciscans are so much better than us. Let me tell you, no, the Dominicans are so... So it's that sense of paradise being lost in the other, in the virtues of someone else. And I am so connected that I don't even worry about myself anymore. It's just a delight in God and a delight in others. So, Beethoven. I love classical music. Beethoven's one of my favorite musician. I remember Sylvia Plath poem where she's talking about Beethoven's Ninth and how hard that chorus is, the Ode to Joy. She said it was almost like Beethoven was pounding his fist on the table into splinters because he was going to get joy out of it no matter what. So there's this real strong push in Beethoven in his time of that really imposing his vision and his genius on things to make things happen. But this is a little quote based on a classic book called Beethoven, I can't remember the name, but it was Beethoven's Spiritual Life or something. So the final achievements of this musical genius embody the final stage of the lifelong development of the great spirit, the stage at which the man for whom suffering earlier was something to assert himself against and triumph over now accepts suffering as, quote, as one of the great structural lines of human life, end quote, and has attained, quote, that unearthly state where the struggle ends and pain dissolves away. I don't know exactly how Beethoven died, but certainly in his late music, late quartets and some of the late piano sonatas and things, there is this sense that he's no longer pounding. He's just in reverence. It reminds me of what Barbara Brown Taylor said when she was struggling with whether to stay in the ministry or not, that she found a lot of people just wanted to have her help them believe But what she wanted to do was just help people behold, you know. And I think Beethoven in his late music, there's a sense of beholding, a mystery and a beauty. And his genius then is all about not having to fight it or mold it his way, but just to give expression to what's extraordinary. Okay, so little diversion, Buddha, Jesus, Dante, Beethoven, but now we'll get back to Santa Barbara, where we are. Getting back to a hospice. A hospice is a safe sanctuary for people on a journey. So that's our building up there. And it didn't occur to me until several years into it. Our logo is a butterfly. And it took me several years to suddenly figure out that the Elwood Mesa out there where the monarchs come is a similar sanctuary. It's almost like a hospice for butterflies. Not to come die, but a place to stop when they're on their journey. To take time, to rest, recuperate, get what they need, and then on they go. So that's the way we see our work, whether it happens in our office. Right now we're seeing about 700 people a month between our office, and we're in 8 public schools, and we're all over the place. But wherever it's, whatever building it's in, the presence, the personal field that we all try to create is to be a safe sanctuary for people on a journey, whether it's a journey towards mortality or a journey after death of grief. So we're doing it in, we have 8 different programs, doing it in all kinds of ways. We're very fortunate that we aren't encumbered by government funding. We don't look for insurance reimbursements. We never charge anybody for anything we do. We leave the medical part to our colleagues at Cottage Hospital and Visiting Nurse and other places, because my predecessors really felt they wanted to focus on that psychosocial, spiritual aspect of mortality, the ones that Cicely Saunders distinguished apart from the physical pain. And we're doing that in all kinds of ways. I'll tell you, some of this story will be familiar to many of you in terms of the kind of work hospice does. Hilda's story. A few years ago, we became aware of a German woman living in town in her 80s, and pretty much alone, just had a few friends in town, had a tenant that wasn't working out very well, and she had COPD, so she had a breathing disorder that isn't the last few months of life, but it's pretty much a steady decline of shortness of breath all the way till death. In medical hospice, you need to be 6 months or less in the doctor's judgment to qualify for those services, but she was a couple years out. But nevertheless, that trajectory was there. Existentially, she was in that process. So we got referred to her and got to know her, and we realized what was important to her, and we ended up putting 4 volunteers with her. One was a paralegal who helped her work out her legal affairs with her tenant. Another was, she loved gardening but had a hard time gardening, so one of our volunteers who loved to garden. Another one was a Reiki therapist who could do like healing touch on her, and over a period of time as that happened, Hildy had less and less anxiety and needed to use her breathing meds less and less. She still needed them, but less so because it wasn't the panicking. And somebody else was just there to drive her or to be with her. In terms of these themes we've been talking about, she started out alone, disconnected. And through those volunteers, regular human beings, specialists in nothing other than being a human being, which is the medicine, spent month after month after month with her, and she began to really feel so different than her isolation. And we got to know that one thing she really loved was dinner parties. She loved to have banquets and things like that. So we worked with the Dream Foundation, and up at our office, she got to create a guest list of people that she wanted. We flew some folks in who couldn't afford it from back east. And on a Saturday, she had a special chef came in, created the whole menu that she had chose, and she got to have a really big party. We called it her Last Supper, but a really big party. And she died about 10 days later. But she died connected, respected, you know. Didn't change the illness. Sometimes you just can't change those things. Sometimes you can, sometimes you can't. But it changed her identity and who she saw herself as because of the love, care, and respect and the individuality that was embodied in what she, the kind of care, and not just care, friendship. You know, neighborliness that we helped organize for her. 3 years ago, we started a project, community spiritual care. And we've got 2 terrific spiritual care folks who are working for us. And part of the grant we got a part of that was to reach out to skilled nursing facilities and retirement homes where they may not have the staff who want to sit with somebody who wants to talk about dying or grieving. And so we are now in six of those facilities, and every week for 2 hours, one of our people goes. Each facility, we've learned, you know, how they want to do it, what works best, who can identify, you know, maybe talk to Mr. So-and-so. Give you an example from one of the places. Anthony showed up, and they said, I think you should talk to this lady over here. She moved in fairly recently, and it just isn't coming out of her apartment. Is just choosing to be disconnected. So he went to visit her, took a little time to establish rapport, as it always does. And it turned out that she'd lost her husband of many, many years. Her identical twin, who they'd been calling each other every day for years, had died in the last year or two. And her kids had moved her from back east out here. So a good reason to feel disconnected, right? So the second visit, Anthony was speaking to her. And suddenly, all this grief and pain came out. The old word for it is catharsis. And Anthony had been a medical chaplain. He'd seen a lot, but he'd never seen this intensity for 25 minutes of it coming out. And then it kind of subsided. Came back the next time. Similar thing. There was more in there. So all of that came out. He asked, do you want me to come back next time? And she said she did. And the fourth time, she said, today, let's go for a walk. I want to see how God is working in nature. So it's the connection again, you know? It's what's disconnecting us and trying to see how, with each individual person, what's going to connect. And then the person on their own feels like they're ready to go out of themselves and out of their place and look outside. It's kind of like Dante's Paradise. Look at nature again and see the meaning there. As I said, we do a lot of work with kids. We have a group called Parenting After Loss. That's where if a mom or a dad has died, we do 8-week programs twice a year where that surviving spouse parent comes with their kids and we have a dinner for them, and then we have an adult support group and a teenage one and elementary school and a preschool, and now we have a Spanish-speaking parenting group. And at the end of one of those 8-week sessions, we gave out evaluations, and there was a 10-year-old boy. And in response to one of the questions, what does this mean to you? He says, it gave me my life back. 10-year-old, gave me my life back. That's why we like to come to work. We're also working, as I mentioned earlier, in 8 schools every week in Santa Barbara and Carpinteria. Several years ago, there was a series of teen suicides in Santa Barbara High. And schools called us in, and they ended up asking us not to go, because even after there are dramatic deaths that maybe make the press, still, if you have a large enough group of people, there's going to be mortality happening to a parent or a grandparent or to a tragedy of a friend in a weekend accident. So we're now at Dos Pueblos and San Marcos and Santa Barbara High, Carpinteria Middle School, El Puente Continuation School, Los Prietos Boys Camp up by Lake Kachuma. And last year, there were 6 kids identified at one of the elementary schools who had lost a parent. So the counselor went in to meet with each of them individually to see if they wanted to just work on one-on-one or if they wanted to be in a group. They wanted to be in a group. So last year, we had a bereavement group for elementary school kids that met with little chairs at one of the elementary schools. And last spring, we did evaluations of all of this. And so one of the things I look forward to is reading these evaluations. And I'm going to show you the comments. Here are the kind of comments that kids put in their own language about what it meant to be able to go through this grief support. You're not alone. Vent your feelings. Talking helps with your grief. Don't do dumb things. We all share something in common. And I've learned how to be confident. It's connecting again. You know, it's death disconnecting us, and then through the groups, which are very powerful, reconnecting with each other. So, should we take a break now? Okay, I've got a little bit more, but I think it's a good time for a break. And we can manage it however we want. Okay, thanks.